Scenes from the Life of a Double Monster. Some years ago, Dr. Fricky asked Lloyd and me a question that I shall try to answer now. With a dreamy smile of scientific delectation, he stroked the fleshy cartilaginous band uniting us, omphalopagus diaphragmo xiphodidymus, as Pancoast has dubbed a similar case, and wondered if we could recall the very first time either of us, or both, realized the peculiarity of our condition and destiny. All Lloyd could remember was the way our grandfather Ibrahim, or Ahim, or Aham, irksome lumps of dead sounds to the ear of today, would touch what the doctor was touching and call it a bridge of gold. I said nothing. Our childhood was spent atop a fertile hill above the Black Sea on our grandfather's farm near Karaz. His youngest daughter, Rose of the East, Grey Aham's Pearl, if so the old scoundrel might have taken better care of her, had been raped in a roadside orchard by our anonymous sire, and had died soon after giving birth to us, of sheer horror and grief, I imagine. One set of rumors mentioned a Hungarian peddler, another favored a German collector of birds or some member of his expedition, his taxidermist, most likely. Dusky, heavily necklaced aunts, whose voluminous clothes smelled of rose oil and mutton, attended with ghoulish zest to the wants of our monstrous infancy. Soon neighboring hamlets learned the astounding news and began delegating to our farm various inquisitive strangers. On feast days you could see them laboring up the slopes of our hill like pilgrims in bright-colored pictures. There was a shepherd 7 feet tall, and a small bald man with glasses and soldiers and the lengthening shadows of cypresses. Children came, too, at all times, and were shooed away by our jealous nurses, but almost daily some black-eyed, crop-haired youngster in dark-patched, faded blue pants would manage to worm his way through the dogwood, the honeysuckle, the twisted Judas trees, into the cobbled court with its own roomy fountain where little Lloyd and Floyd, we had other names then, full of corvine aspirates, but no matter, sat quietly munching dried apricots under a whitewashed wall. Then, suddenly, the H would see an I, the Roman II a one, the scissors a knife. There can be, of course, no comparison between this impact of knowledge, disturbing as it may have been, and the emotional shock my mother received. By the way, what clean bliss there is in this deliberate use of the possessive singular. She must have been aware that she was being delivered of twins, but when she learned, as no doubt she did, that the twins were conjoined ones, what did she experience then? With the kind of unrestrained, ignorant, passionately communicative folks that surrounded us, the highly vocal household just beyond the limits of her tumbled bed must, surely, have told her at once that something had gone dreadfully wrong. And one can be certain that her sisters, in the frenzy of their frightened compassion, showed her the double baby. I am not saying that a mother cannot love such a double thing, and forget in this love the dark dews of its unhallowed origin. I only think that the mixture of revulsion, pity, and a mother's love was too much for her. Both components of the double series before her staring eyes were healthy, handsome little components, with a silky fair fuzz on their violet-pink skulls and well-formed rubbery arms and legs that moved like the many limbs of some wonderful sea animal. Each was eminently normal, but together they formed a monster. Indeed, it is strange to think that the presence of a mere band of tissue, a flap of flesh not much longer than a lamb's liver, should be able to transform joy, pride, tenderness, adoration, gratitude to God, into horror and despair. In our own case, everything was far simpler. Adults were much too different from us in all respects to afford any analogy, but our first coeval visitor was to me a mild revelation. While Lloyd placidly contemplated the awestruck child of 7 or 8 who was peering at us from under a humped and likewise peering fig tree, I remember appreciating in full the essential difference between the newcomer and me. He cast a short blue shadow on the ground, and so did I. But in addition to that sketchy and flat and unstable companion which he and I owed to the sun and which vanished in dull weather, I possessed yet another shadow. A palpable reflection of my corporal self, that I always had by me, at my left side, whereas my visitor had somehow managed to lose his, or had unhooked it and left it at home. Linked, Lloyd and Floyd were complete and normal. He was neither. But perhaps, in order to elucidate these matters as thoroughly as they deserve, I should say something of still earlier recollections. Unless adult emotions stain past ones, I think I can vouch for the memory of a faint disgust. By virtue of our anterior duplexity, we lay originally front to front, joined at our common navel, and my face in those first years of our existence was constantly brushed by my twin's hard nose and wet lips. A tendency to throw our heads back and avert our faces as much as possible was a natural reaction to those bothersome contacts. The great flexibility of our band of union allowed us to assume, reciprocally, a more or less lateral position, and as we learned to walk, we waddled about in this side-by-side attitude, which must have seemed more strained than it really was, making us look, I suppose, like a pair of drunken dwarfs supporting each other. For a long time we kept reverting in sleep to our fetal position, but whenever the discomfort it engendered woke us up, we would again jerk our faces away, in regardant revulsion, with a double wail. I insist that at 3 or 4 our bodies obscurely disliked their clumsy conjunction, while our minds did not question its normalcy. Then, before we could have become mentally aware of its drawbacks, physical intuition discovered means of tempering them, and thereafter we hardly gave them a thought. All our movements became a judicious compromise between the common and the particular. The pattern of acts prompted by this or that mutual urge formed a kind of gray, evenly woven, generalized background against which the discrete impulse, his or mine, followed a brighter and sharper course. But, guided as it were by the warp of the background pattern, it never went athwart the common weave or the other twin's whim. I am speaking at present solely of our childhood, when nature could not yet afford to have us undermine our hard-won vitality by any conflict between us. In later years I have had occasion to regret that we did not perish, or had not been surgically separated, before we left that initial stage at which an ever-present rhythm, like some kind of remote tom-tom beating in the jungle of our nervous system, was alone responsible for the regulation of our movements. When, for example, one of us was about to stoop to possess himself of a pretty daisy, and the other, at exactly the same moment, was on the point of stretching up to pluck a ripe fig, individual success depended upon whose movement happened to conform to the current ictus of our common and continuous rhythm, whereupon, with a very brief, chorea-like shiver, the interrupted gesture of one twin would be swallowed and dissolved in the enriched ripple of the other's completed action. I say enriched because the ghost of the unpicked flower somehow seemed to be also there, pulsating between the fingers that closed upon the fruit. There might be a period of weeks and even months when the guiding beat was much more often on Lloyd's side than on mine, and then a period might follow when I would be on top of the wave. But I cannot recall any time in our childhood when frustration or success in these matters provoked in either of us resentment or pride. Somewhere within me, however, there must have been some sensitive cell wondering at the curious fact of a force that would suddenly sweep me away from the object of a casual desire and drag me to other, uncoveted things that were thrust into the sphere of my will instead of being consciously reached for and enveloped by its tentacles. So, as I watched this or that chance child which was watching Lloyd and me, I remember pondering a twofold problem. First, whether perhaps a single bodily state had more advantages than ours possessed, and second, whether all other children were single. It occurs to me now that quite often problems puzzling me were twofold. Possibly a trickle of Lloyd's cerebration penetrated my mind, and one of the two linked problems was his. When greedy grandfather Ahem decided to show us to visitors for money, among the flocks that came there was always some eager rascal who wanted to hear us talk to each other. As happens with primitive minds, he demanded that his ears corroborate what his eyes saw. Our folks bullied us into gratifying such desires and could not understand what was so distressful about them. We could have pleaded shyness, but the truth was that we never really spoke to each other, even when we were alone, for the brief broken grunts of infrequent expostulation that we sometimes exchanged, when, for instance, one had just cut his foot and had had it bandaged and the other wanted to go paddling in the brook, could hardly pass for dialogue. The communication of simple essential sensations we performed wordlessly, shed leaves riding the stream of our shared blood. Thin thoughts also managed to slip through and travel between us, richer ones each kept to himself, but even then there occurred odd phenomena. This is why I suspect that despite his calmer nature, Lloyd was struggling with the same new realities that were puzzling me. He forgot much when he grew up. I have forgotten nothing. Not only did our public expect us to talk, it also wanted us to play together. Dolts. They derived quite a kick from having us match wits at checkers or muslah. I suppose had we happened to be opposite-sex twins, they would have made us commit incest in their presence. But since mutual games were no more customary with us than conversation, we suffered subtle torments when obliged to go through the cramped motions of bandying a ball somewhere between our breastbones, or making believe to wrest the stick from each other. We drew wild applause by running around the yard with our arms around each other's shoulders. We could jump and twirl. A salesman of patent medicine, a bald little fellow in a dirty white Russian blouse who knew some Turkish and English, taught us sentences in these languages, and then we had to demonstrate our ability to a fascinated audience. Their ardent faces still pursue me in my nightmares, for they come whenever my dream producer needs supers. I see again the gigantic bronze-faced shepherd in multicolored rags, the soldiers from Karaz, the one-eyed, hunchbacked Armenian tailor, a monster in his own right, the giggling girls, the sighing old women, the children, the young people in Western clothes, burning eyes, white teeth, black gaping mouths, and, of course, Grandfather Ahem, with his nose of yellow ivory and his beard of gray wool, directing the proceedings or counting the soiled paper money and wetting his big thumb. The linguist, he of the embroidered blouse and bald head, courted one of my aunts, but kept watching Ahem enviously through his steel-rimmed spectacles. By the age of 9, I knew quite clearly that Lloyd and I presented the rarest of freaks. This knowledge provoked in me neither any special elation nor any special shame. But once a hysterical cook, a mustachioed woman who had taken a great liking to us and pitied our plight, declared with an atrocious oath that she would then and there slice us free by means of a shiny knife that she suddenly flourished. She was at once overpowered by our grandfather and one of our newly acquired uncles, and after that incident I would often dally with an indolent daydream, fancying myself somehow separated from poor Lloyd, who somehow retained his monsterhood. I did not care for that knife business, and anyway the manner of separation remained very vague, but I distinctly imagined the sudden melting away of my shackles and the feeling of lightness and nakedness that would ensue. I imagined myself climbing over the fence, a fence with bleached skulls of farm animals that crowned its pickets, and descending toward the beach. I saw myself leaping from boulder to boulder and diving into the twinkling sea, and scrambling back onto the shore and scampering about with other naked children. I dreamt of this at night, saw myself fleeing from my grandfather and carrying away with me a toy or a kitten or a little crab pressed to my left side. I saw myself meeting poor Lloyd, who appeared to me in my dream, hobbling along, hopelessly joined to a hobbling twin, while I was free to dance around them and slap them on their humble backs. I wonder if Lloyd had similar visions. It has been suggested by doctors that we sometimes pooled our minds when we dreamed. One gray-blue morning he picked up a twig and drew a ship with 3 masts in the dust. I had just seen myself drawing that ship in the dust of a dream I had dreamed the preceding night. An ample black shepherd's cloak covered our shoulders, and as we squatted on the ground, all but our heads and Lloyd's hand was concealed within its falling folds. The sun had just risen, and the sharp March air was like layer upon layer of semi-transparent ice, through which the crooked Judas tree in rough bloom made blurry spots of purplish pink. The long, low white house behind us, full of fat women and their foul-smelling husbands, was fast asleep. We did not say anything. We did not even look at each other. But throwing his twig away, Lloyd put his right arm around my shoulder, as he always did when he wished both of us to walk fast. And with the edge of our common raiment trailing among dead weeds, while pebbles kept running from under our feet, we made our way toward the alley of cypresses that led down to the shore. It was our first attempt to visit the sea that we could see from our hilltop, softly glistening afar and leisurely, silently breaking on glossy rocks. I need not strain my memory at this point to place our stumbling flight at a definite turn in our destiny. A few weeks before, on our 12th birthday, Grandfather Ibrahim had started to toy with the idea of sending us in the company of our newest uncle on a 6-month tour through the country. They kept haggling about the terms and had quarreled and even fought, Ahem getting the upper hand. We feared our grandfather and loathed Uncle Novus. Presumably, after a dull, forlorn fashion, knowing nothing of life but being dimly aware that Uncle Novus was endeavoring to cheat Grandfather, we felt we should try to do something in order to prevent a showman from trundling us around in a moving prison like apes or eagles, or perhaps we were prompted merely by the thought that this was our last chance to enjoy by ourselves our small freedom and do what we were absolutely forbidden to do, go beyond a certain picket fence, open a certain gate. We had no trouble in opening that rickety gate, but did not manage to swing it back into its former position. A dirty white lamb with amber eyes and a carmine mark painted upon its hard, flat forehead followed us for a while before getting lost in the oak scrub. A little lower but still far above the valley, we had to cross the road that circled around the hill and connected our farm with the highway running along the shore. The thudding of hooves and the rasping of wheels came descending upon us, and we dropped, cloak and all, behind a bush. When the rumble subsided, we crossed the road and continued along a weedy slope. The silvery sea gradually concealed itself behind cypresses and remnants of old stone walls. Our black cloak began to feel hot and heavy, but still we persevered under its protection, being afraid that otherwise some passerby might notice our infirmity. We emerged upon the highway, a few feet from the audible sea, and there, waiting for us under a cypress, was a carriage we knew, a cart-like affair on high wheels with Uncle Novus in the act of getting down from the box. Crafty, dark, ambitious, unprincipled little man. A few moments before he had caught sight of us from one of the galleries of our grandfather's house and had not been able to resist the temptation of taking advantage of an escapade which miraculously allowed him to seize us without any struggle or outcry. Swearing at the two timorous horses, he roughly helped us into the cart. He pushed our heads down and threatened to hurt us if we attempted to peep from under our cloak. Lloyd's arm was still around my shoulder, but a jerk of the cart shook it off. Now the wheels were crunching and rolling. It was some time before we realized that our driver was not taking us home. 20 years have passed since that gray spring morning, but it is much better preserved in my mind than many a later event. Again and again I run it before my eyes like a strip of cinematic film, as I have seen great jugglers do when reviewing their acts. So I review all the stages and circumstances and incidental details of our abortive flight, the initial shiver, the gate, the lamb, the slippery slope under our clumsy feet. To the thrushes we flushed, we must have presented an extraordinary sight, with that black cloak around us and our two shorn heads on thin necks sticking out of it. The heads turned this way and that, warily, as at last the shoreline highway was reached. If at that moment some adventurous stranger had stepped onto the shore from his boat in the bay, he would have surely experienced a thrill of ancient enchantment to find himself confronted by a gentle, mythological monster in a landscape of cypresses and white stones. He would have worshipped it. He would have shed sweet tears. But alas, there was nobody to greet us there save that worried crook, our nervous kidnapper, a small, doll-faced man wearing cheap spectacles, one glass of which was doctored with a bit of tape.